Hey everyone, Will Cooper here, host of Hunt Stand's Make Your Mark podcast. Join us as we dive deep into the world of hunting and outdoor pursuits. We've brought together some of the most accomplished individuals in the industry to share their invaluable insights and experiences with you. But here's the kicker. It's not just about hunting tips and tactics. We're exploring how you can carve your own path, elevate your skills, and gain some wisdom from the best in the field. So whether you're a seasoned hunter looking to fine-tune your skills or a newbie eager to learn, our podcast has something for everyone. Stay tuned for more exciting guests and hotter topics. Don't miss out and subscribe to Hunt Stand's Make Your Mark podcast today and start making your mark in the great outdoors.
Whether you're just looking to stay warm during a hunt or need maximum concealment, the clothing you wear can make or break a hunt. At MidwayUSA.com, we understand hunting clothing has come a long way with more meticulously crafted camo patterns, advanced scent control technologies, and weatherproof options to withstand the elements. Hunters have to wait until their favorite season, but shouldn't wait on gear, which is why MidwayUSA offers super fast shipping. When you're ready for your next system, log on to MidwayUSA.com.
The black bear is one of the most impressive predators in North America, ranging up to 300 or more pounds. And on this episode, we're going to talk about the tactics, the guns, the gear, and the aftershot care that goes into hunting these outstanding predators. Hey, and welcome to another episode of the New Hunter's Guide, the podcast and YouTube channel helping new hunters get started and helping active hunters learn new things. Well, today we are diving deeper into black bear hunting. I've got back with me Jeff Lund, who's from southeastern Alaska, has spent his life growing up around black bears and all the amazing game in Alaska. He is the author of the podcast, The Mediocre Alaskan, which provides a real-world picture of round the clock, round the year, lifestyle, hunting, fishing, and everything in between what really happens in Alaska. Author of the book, A Miserable Paradise, also a published author, teacher, and just all-around Alaskan, just pouring information and insight and helpful content out there about the place that he lives. Jeff, welcome to the show. It's great to have you today.
Thanks, man. You're quite the hype man.
Hey, I've been through some of your stuff. I've read some of your material, listened to some of your shows. I'm a big fan of what you're doing. I'm a big fan of all things Alaska. I've got all of the different Alaska shows saved on Amazon Prime, watch them all, buy every season. And of course, you only get a fraction of the picture there. And what you're putting out is the whole thing. It's the whole truth. It's the full picture. And it's just so much awesome stuff. And so much of it, I think, especially when you're talking about predator hunting and bear hunting, is transferable to numerous states across the nation. And just a lot of really helpful stuff. So I really appreciate what you're doing there.
Thank you. Appreciate that. And I will say that those shows are pretty fun to watch as like guilty pleasure shows. And a lot of that stuff at times is pretty accurate, but there is a reality to living up here that the producers don't really even know to guess at. It's like, oh, we're going to manufacture this conflict when really this other conflict would probably be that much more interesting. But there's a lot of different people can give you a lot of different advice. And so anything that I'm going to say is going to be based mostly in like Southeast Alaska, whereas the whole program, if you go up to Kodiak or the interior, is going to be much, much different. So I'll speak more to what I know. And that's Southern and Southeast Alaska.
Yeah, that's awesome. So guys, if you missed it, we did a previous episode, which was sort of your level one introduction, mostly for people who've had some hunting experience, maybe hunted deer before, decided it was time to go after black bear. We talked about, why would you hunt them, the different places that they live, if habits, habitat, where do you find them, primary hunting strategies. Make sure you go back, check out that episode if you missed it. This is part two. We're going to dive in deeper here. And Jeff, I want to start with the first question on my list. How should new hunters get started in bear hunting? I'm not saying people that are brand new to the sport. I mean, they've hunted something before, so they've got some of the basics down, but they've never hunted a bear before, maybe never hunted any predator before, but they've got black bears on the mind and they want to move in that direction, how should they get started?
I think you have to, everyone has to deal with that epic hunt, you know, that one that's kind of in the back of their minds. And I think any hunter has got to toil with Alaska. You know, you got to come to terms with what's going to get you up here. And is it going to be, you know, Sitka blacktail deer? Is it going to be caribou, moose? Is it going to be bear? So I think if that's on your list, I think a black bear in Southeast Alaska is just an absolutely, it's got all the adventure you could want. And so whatever your goals are, just, you know, match that. If you want to get a couple black bear under your belt first before you come up and do that, that, you know, that's fine. But it's just kind of what you want from hunting, how adventurous do you want to be? Like, by all means, if you want your first black bear to be the epic trip to Alaska, then it absolutely can be. And I think Southern Southeast Alaska is great for that, because you're looking more at just black bear in most areas and not mixing with brown bear and black bear, which can complicate things, especially because, or maybe first, because brown bears require guides in some areas. But, you know, if it's your first bear, it's definitely a spot that's doable. It's going to be difficult. It's going to be different than you probably imagined. But I think it just comes down to goals as a hunter and what you're comfortable with, because if you're not really comfortable, then maybe, you know, it's not the first hunt for you. But, you know, if you want to get after it, then go for it.
Yeah, that's awesome. So in your experience, how big is a mature, full grown black bear going to weigh in at? Not the max that they can be, but, you know, if you went out and you found a good one, you know, what kind of weight would you be looking at?
It's kind of tough to tell. Like, there are certain areas where, you know, if you're next to a river that has a ton of fish, like, you can get bears that are just, you know, like, almost scraping their bellies, and just huge. And in other places, just, you know, they're not quite as big. You can see the difference in, like, a brown bear that lives in Katmai that's, you know, just huge. So average adult male bear is like 150, 200 pounds, something like that. But they could be, you know, 20, 30% more than that in the fall after they've just been putting on fat so much. So, you know, you can get up to 350 pound black bear, which is crazy. And you're going to get 100 or so, 120, 140 pounds of meat from that.
So you could be going toe to toe with a 300 pound bear, and that's not an unrealistic possibility.
The toe to toe part might be, but like you're anticipating, this is a big deal. I know that, you know, brown bear is going to get you, or grizzly bear is going to get you a lot more attention from people if you say you went up to Alaska and went grizzly hunting or brown bear hunting, but, you know, black bears are no joke. That's for sure.
It's probably going to cost a lot more to go brown bear hunting as well, wouldn't it?
Yeah, you're looking at your non-resident hunting license is $160, and I think the harvest, it's non-resident, it's $450, I believe. So you're into it for, what was that, $610 before the plane ticket, and your plane ticket, let's see here, I just actually checked this. Pittsburgh, because you're in Pennsylvania, right? So Pittsburgh to Ketchikan, you're looking at about $300 to $350 one way. So you could probably around $800 or so in tickets to get up here, and then $610 for the license and the tag. It's a harvest ticket, so you can get that over the counter. You can buy that online, so you don't have to worry about winning a draw. In certain areas, there is a draw in Unit 1 Prince of Wales, or Unit 2 Prince of Wales, which is kind of famous for having really good populations of black bear and very large black bear. There is a draw if you want to do it that's not guided. I think in the previous episode, I said that you had to draw for non-guided. So check your regulations just to make sure, because they could change year in and year out. So double check that with the regulations. And I'll send you the links so you can put that in the show notes.
Yeah, sounds great.
So it's pretty expensive, but, you know, depending on how much you save, and if you value this experience, then, you know, you can make that happen. So, but you're going to be into it for a little over a grand just with tickets and license and tag.
And if you were doing brown bear instead, you probably have to layer on guides and more expensive tags, I'd imagine.
Yeah, you're going further north, and I'm not sure what the going rate for that is, but I would assume you're talking tens of thousands of dollars, maybe a $5,000 to $10,000.
Yeah, so probably not a play for a new hunter there. Black bear's a much easier entry point.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause you can do it yourself. And also you don't want, you know, you don't want to get over your head. You don't want to have a book written about you because you're unprepared like Chris McCandless or Timothy Treadwell. Not to defame them. Sure. I mean, you can discuss, like, they have merits to the way that they lived and what they did. Like, there's nothing at all wrong with what they did. Don't get me wrong. But you know, there is a tragic something in their story that led to their demise. And that's not what you want.
Yeah, coming home from the hunt, that's got to be priority number one. Mm. So you're going up, you know, going up after bears that may weigh upwards of 300 pounds. What kind of guns and gear do you need to go at them? I know everybody wants to know about the firearms piece first. So, you know, maybe let's just drill into that. What do you recommend to go after that? Because you got to have two things, I would imagine. You got to have at least some range, and then you got to have enough knockdown power to put one of those down without going too far.
Yeah. First of all, just to clarify real quick there, I gave you, I misquoted the price. Guy I know that does guided Kodiak brown bear hunts, the rates for 2021 were $24,000.
Wow.
And that's brown bear hunts Kodiak October 24th through November 3rd. So I mean, it's super expensive, but I mean, you're talking, this is a world-class guide and these are world-class bears. So this is the top of the top of the top. So if you're able to save that money, or, you know, you got in on Bitcoin pretty early, then that's going to be what it costs. That's just the reality. You know, if you want a brown bear, like, it's not just not going to be something you can easily do. Whereas black bear, it's going to be a little bit different. A little bit cheaper there, but so as far as caliber goes, I'll go back to black bear here. I use a 270, 150 grain bullet. I am of the shot placement group where I really need to make sure that I'm making a good shot. I know some people will say, you know, caliber up, get the biggest gun that you can shoot, and take out one of the shoulders so it can't run away. But I just like being able to shoot a weapon that I'm familiar with, that I can shoot a bunch, that I'm not scared to practice with. Because if there is some element of buck fever, of bear fever, of whatever, you know, you want to be able to put that thing as close as possible. So if you're nervous and you're shooting a weapon that's way bigger than you're used to, you know, you're talking about, you know, out of the boiler room to a spot where you're wounding an animal, and it's going to take a lot more time to recover. So a 270 is what I prefer. 30-06 is a good weapon as well. So there's really no need to come up with some brand new rifle that is some massive caliber that you only practice with five or seven times because your shoulder hurts. You know, whatever you can shoot well, I wouldn't go any lower than a 270. But a 270 30-06 is great because you can shoot those all day. You can practice. You can get really good. You can focus on a really good shot that's going to put that animal down. For the animal's sake, obviously, you don't want an animal suffering. And then also, you know, for your sake, you want to have that peace of mind that the animal's down. That, you know, you take that breath. The job is done. You're not worried about tracking an animal into the dark, into the woods, into wherever. So a 270 is my preferred with a 150 grain.
Nice. And, you know, I've seen through deer hunting, and I imagine it's somewhat similar through bear hunting. While on paper it should not be possible, I'm constantly shocked at how far a deer can run or in some way locomote minus a shoulder if nothing more vital than that has been hit. They're just incredibly resilient creatures, and I'd imagine only bears are more so.
Yeah, for sure. And that's, you know, the last thing you want to do is harm an animal. You want these things to be super, super clean kills. And that's, you know, you just want that to happen, and they're going to be resilient. So you want to put that shot in the right spot and make that happen as easy as possible. And sometimes, you know, you'll hit it and it's over, you know, and that's great. Like my brown bear was like that. I went brown bear hunting with a 30-06 with a 220 grain and just dropped it, which was kind of surprising. But, you know, I airmailed the first one. I gave it a warning shot on the first one. Cause I didn't have it was somewhat obstructed because there's a little bit of a rise between me and it. It was about 300 yards. I just sent it over the top and then it kind of ran toward us, at an angle. So it was coming closer to shore and then it just kind of stopped for a second and then shot and dropped it like just dead, stone dead, which brown bear with a 30-06. And it was a pretty old, bear, but you know, good shot placement. It's so important. And you just don't want to lose the bear and have to notch the tag without getting it. You don't want some crazy adventure. You just want to take care of it, respect the animal by getting it done.
Knives, machetes, saws, and shears, multi-tools, shovels, swords, axes, spears, hatchets, and tomahawks. If it cuts, snips, slices, or chops, Midway USA has it. Find great gift ideas in our huge selection of pocket knives and other everyday carry folding knives. Make a statement or create a family legacy with one of our top-of-the-line hunting knives. We've got a great selection of manual and electric sharpeners, too. For just about everything for the outdoors, check out MidwayUSA.com. MidwayUSA brand product designers have one straightforward goal: develop high-quality, technically sound products and deliver them to customers at reasonable prices. If you are immersed in the shooting sports industry and pay close attention to every single detail, you know our products are built right and stand up to everyday use. Who has shooting mats and range bag systems to hunting clothing and just about everything for the outdoors? Log on and shop 24/7 with super fast shipping. MidwayUSA.com.
Sure. Of course, now I'm going to ask you the question that's almost impossible to answer effectively via audio format, but what is the best shot placement? Where do you want to put that bullet given the ideal circumstance?
You know, your heart and lungs. If you can hit the heart, you know, if you're looking at, like, rather than look at the entire animal and try to hit the entire animal, if you're looking at a 1-inch patch of fur and behind that you're seeing the heart, if you can superimpose that as you're making that call, then go for that. People also say double lung, you know, it's the same thing. You know, some people say, I want to aim for the exact heart. Other people say, you know, if you come back a little bit and maybe you don't, if you aim for the heart, maybe nick the shoulder or something like that, you know, so double lung it, you're going to be good to go. It's going to be difficult for it to run too far because its lungs are compromised. But then, you know, other people say you put the first one in the shoulder so it can't run away and finish it off with something else. Like, I don't know, like different people are going to have different convincing arguments for different things, but you know, I'm trying to put one in the heart. That's kind of where I go, like that sort of small area. So the more focused you are with where you're aiming, I think the better your shooting is going to be. If you're aiming for the whole area, lungs or heart, then you know, maybe all of a sudden you're hitting beyond that. So focus down to something that's very, very small, whether your focal point is like one part of the lungs or the heart. I think that's the key to putting a good shot.
Sure. And, you know, I never want to be someone that, you know, is a downer on other people's methodology, but I come from the school of, you know, two shots is not a plan. Two shots is what you do when a plan fails. You should plan to take that animal with one shot because you just don't know. Mm-hmm. I mean, you hit it in the shoulder and a good shot, bad shot, maybe it runs, maybe you don't get another shot, maybe it backs up, maybe it rolls over, maybe you can't hit him on the move with the follow-up shot. To me, that just seems like, okay, that's plan B, but, you know, plan A feels like, all right, you need to make a kill shot with that first one. You know, and I imagine from, you know, 30 yards versus 300 yards, you know, where you can put that bullet confidently is going to vary some. From your experience, what kind of ranges do you think are reasonable for people to expect and practice at?
It's so funny because it doesn't matter what you say. There's going to be some like non-hunter who would be like, this is outrageous. And then even some hunter too, that would be like, oh, that's totally ridiculous. You don't want to be hunting black bears or anything less than this. Or someone probably said, oh, you can hunt black bear with 243. Like, whatever, man. It ultimately comes down to whatever you are most comfortable with and whatever you believe in. But I totally agree with the, you know, it should be a one one-shot program should definitely be what you're going with. But I actually forgot your question. What was your question?
Oh yeah, no worries. So what kind of shot ranges do you think you're looking at or should practice at?
You know, I think it's good to be, you know, whatever you can do. Like there are some ranges that don't have, you know, stuff out past 200, 300 yards. And so the last thing you want is to, you know, you sight your rifle in at 100 and you feel great, 'cause all you have to do is just do a calculation or look at the bullet drop on the side of the box and say, all right, well, you know, 300, it's going to drop 6 inches. So I'll just plan for that and shoot. So, you know, shoot wherever you can, and then be honest with the guide or with yourself when you're out there and you think, all right, well, I've shot to 100 a lot and I feel great at 100. Maybe you don't shoot past 150, 200. If you haven't shot to 200, then your first time shooting at 200 should probably not be at a bear that you've spent, you know, $1,200, $1,500, $1,800 just to get here. So, I think your expectation, could be on the grass flats or so in the spring, could be, you know, 200-300 yards, but you know, you can also make good moves. If the wind is right, you can get around. They have terrible vision, like I said before in the previous episode, and you can get to, you know, 50, 75 yards. You can get even closer than that. So depending on your setup, depending on the wind, it's definitely reasonable to think about 100 as expected. But you know, older boars might get used to animals or to people being around them. And so those animals are going to be a little bit more, likely to maybe move. And so you might not be able to get super close to them. So you might be looking at a longer shot, but I don't see why you should expect to shoot, you know, 300, 400, something crazy. It's not, you know, stalking a caribou on the tundra or anything like that. So 100, 200 definitely is probably for spring. For fall, probably a little bit closer than that, because you're probably going to be hunting near rivers, things like that. And so it's pretty tight quarters. And so your shots are probably going to be shorter.
Right. I think you make a great point there in terms of practice. I mean, guys, you can't just grab the box of ammo and say, oh, well, okay, I need to aim this high at that range. Those numbers may or may not line up with your rifle. They may not have, you know, they might have shot those test groups at the factory with a different barrel length, different barrel twist, different conditions. Those numbers might be a calculation. They might not even be the real numbers. And sometimes, you know, ammo manufacturers give you velocities and ranges and drops that are optimistic, to say the best.
Yeah.
So I think whatever you want to hunt with, get out there on the range, practice with that rifle, with that round, at any range that you plan on taking a shot at, and make sure you can hit a target smaller than the one that you're going to be aiming at. Because once you get that adrenaline and your heart's pumping and you might not have a good shooting position, you got to allow yourself some margin at a previously tested range.
Yeah. You could look at your target and you're a little bit left on one, a little bit high on another, a little bit right, but you're all, you know, within quarter inch, half inch of the bullseye. So you're feeling really good about yourself that you're almost touching the bullseye, or maybe you are touching the bullseye, but then you expand that angle out to 300 yards and then you expand a little bit of a twitch and all of a sudden, you know, you're 4, 5, 6 inches off. And that's a huge, huge, huge deal. And if you are hitting an animal or hitting a bear far back, and then, you know, you're tracking it and there's a ton of blood, not as much blood. And all of a sudden there's no blood, that dialed in at 100, you know, all of a sudden is a huge problem because there's no bear trail. The bear could be dead somewhere, but you know, as I mentioned in the previous episode, that once that fat and once all that thick fur starts to kind of dry and coagulate, all the bleeding is inside. So, you know, it's not going to be easy. And if you're in a wet environment, it's going to be harder to track an animal as it is. If it's raining or everything is damp and moist, that blood trail is going to go away. So you want to be able to put this down and have a good memory and not some harrowing, you know, adventure of how you walked up on it and it was still alive and you had to put 3 or 4 more rounds in it. So your bear just absolutely suffered. So you want to put that down and get it over with.
Oh yeah, absolutely. So obviously the rifle is going to be a critical piece of gear. What other gear items do you think are must-haves or must-haves to consider for black bear hunting?
I think any archer wants to come up and do a black bear hunt, especially because a black bear seems a lot more accessible than a brown bear, and it is. And so all that stuff definitely plays in for sure. But then shooting is so important there, or even more so, because you know, we practice standing shooting. Stand, shoot, stand, shoot. But there are times when you're going to be behind a piece of driftwood, or you're going to be behind a rock, and you're going to have to kneel. You know, so have you drawn your bow, and are you making great shots kneeling? You know, and are there things in your way? And have you sat when it's cold? My issue last year with black-tailed deer hunting was the deer came in right exactly where I wanted, but I've been sitting for an hour. And I was cold and it was raining and I had my hood all the way up and it was zipped up. It was one of those hoods that the one, the Sitka hoodies that kind of, you know, makes half your face disappear. And so when I drew back, it was hard to find that anchor correctly because, like, you know, the jawline feels different from through the fabric. And so I had never practiced, you know, I would practice, you know, 30, 40, 50 yards and, you know, put the target back in some brush just so I had distraction, just so it was a little bit different. I shot from my knees, but I'd never shot from, you know, my face being somewhat covered by material. And so I didn't find my anchor right. And I shot 3 inches in front of the thing. So I was almost a foot off. I was super excited and I was cold and I totally pulled it. It was terrible. But you know, all those short sort of shooting situations, it's not just about being able to stand in your shorts and you're comfortable and you're shooting tacks up to 50, 60 yards. It's about, can you sit and you're chilly and then find it when it matters? So the archery thing definitely is, I'm sure, appealing to any archer who wants to come up and then want to get a black bear, at least thinking about it. So that's just as important in as many angles as you can think of with all the gear that you have is super, super important as well.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I imagine time of the year, season, where exactly you're hunting, you know, the rest of the gear is going to vary tremendously based upon all those factors. There's almost no one recommendation you could probably make in terms of what you need to wear or what else you need to have with you or on you in terms of just, you know, how to go out there and how to do it under any one set of conditions.
Yeah. I would say that probably the gear that's probably the most in the spring would definitely be waders, and not boot in waders because you don't have the same sort of traction. So if you get the neoprene booty waders with the boots, because it's just you're going to be wet, you're going to be hiking through, you know, it's tidal, so you might need them just getting off the boat to get to shore. Just keeping you dry, keeping you warmer, because you could be sitting out in spring and it's raining. And those waders are going to keep you drier and warmer. Good rain jacket. Water resistant means you'll just get less wet, but you will get wet. So I would sacrifice some really nice new like camo design for something that's going to actually keep you dry, because bears don't have great vision. If you do have your profile broken up a little bit, that might help you a little bit, especially if you're in close quarters. If you're going archery, that might be a good idea. But for long range type stuff, just whatever's going to keep you dry and going to keep you comfortable is going to be huge. And that's going to go the same thing for fall, because especially Southeast Alaska here, we get so much rain that, you know, if you're getting cold and you have to sit and you're waiting for something to come out, you're not going to be as patient. You know, just going to be a more miserable experience. So, having layers is really important, and a good outer jacket. I have a pair of Grundin's bibs. They're like the fishing bibs that you see on Deadliest Catch, not quite as thick. They don't make as much a sound. You can buy a lighter version of them, but I mean, they're absolutely waterproof. They insulate pretty well too. So you're going to be probably pretty hot from walking around and hike around in those things, but you're going to be dry. No matter where you sit, you're going to stay dry. So we're talking waterproof things, not some nice, light, breathable, packable stuff. Cause that stuff, if it's light and breathable, it's going to get wet. Like if air can get through, water is going to find its way through. So, waterproof gear is just absolutely vital for your ability to stay out as long as you need to, comfort, enjoyment, all that stuff.
Yeah, so probably the same kind of stuff you'd wear on a day where you're hunting ducks and it's 40 degrees and downpour. That's the same kind of approach you ought to be taking to keep yourself dry, warm, and still alive.
Yeah, I've definitely seen people wear that sort of stuff. The when you're on the beaches, you're going to have a lot of sharp rocks, and you're going to have rocks that have barnacles and things like that on them. So, you know, that could be, it could be tough on neoprene. It's better to be hot than cold, you know, like there's always cases of people who are, get hypothermic, and that's, you know, it's September, or, you know, it's August. I got the hypothermic in August, 2 years ago. It was just rainy. And I was waiting for the fog to clear. And I was just sitting there. And, you know, I could just feel that I couldn't feel my toes, and then I couldn't feel from my fingers to my wrists. I'm like, gosh, dang it. Now I got to get up and walk around. But, you know, if it's your first time with that, like, you don't really know, you kind of go right to the shaking uncontrollable phase, and it could be a little different. But, you know, growing up in Southeast Alaska, I've fallen through the ice twice. Like, you know, I've been out. It doesn't mean that I don't take it seriously. It's just that, okay, this is what I need to do in this case. And what I need to do in this case is get up and walk around, get the blood flowing. Because this is not a sit and rewarm. This is not a, I put the hand warmer out and put it in my hands. Like, this is, I need to get the blood flowing. So you just don't want to be miserable. You know, you want your trip to be fun, and you can say, yeah, it sucked because it was raining the whole time, but, you know, we got it done because I was prepared.
Yeah, absolutely. And I can relate to that from hunting just about anything else. When it's cold, wet, rainy, and your gear is terrible, it doesn't take much to put you in that kind of a condition.
The 1911 is one of the most iconic firearms in history. Designed by John Browning, the 1911 was the standard issue sidearm of the U.S. military from 1911 to 1985. While Colt produced the original, almost every major firearm company has produced its own version. It's wildly revered for its reliability, crisp trigger, and is still a favorite for all types of shooters. Whether you're looking to buy or build a 1911, and just about everything for guns, log on to MidwayUSA.com. At MidwayUSA, we know the AR-15 is one of the most popular rifles in modern American history. Known for its modularity and widespread use, it's often considered essential to any gun collection. The essential things you need to run an AR-15 are usually always in stock during shortages, things like magazines and 5.56 ammo. Whether you're looking to buy a new AR-15 or buy parts for your modern sporting rifle, log on, and for just about everything for the outdoors, shop MidwayUSA.com.
So, say you got your gear, you got your rifle, you got your bow, you take your shot, that animal goes down, you track it, you find it, you got a dead animal there, you take pictures, some selfies, maybe you do a little dance, then, okay, pull out a knife. Now, how do you go about the dressing part? You know, you might have to cover some distance, or get this thing to a boat, or, you know, what's the next steps that happen once you've got the animal on the ground?
I like a couple different knives. One fixed blade. I know there's a huge rage with, and I have a couple of those disposable blades because they're so great. Havilon, Gerber make unbelievably sharp knives that are disposable that last a pretty long time. So I have Gerber, but, you know, Gerber, Havilon, whatever. But when you are, I'm assuming a lot of people come up here, they want to make a rug out of the Black Bear. And so you're going to want a fixed blade knife that when you're getting in, the claw area or the paw area, you're going to be able to move and get those ligaments and get those tendons out there. And if you tweak those blades or you turn those disposable blades, are going to snap. So you're going to want a nice fixed blade knife. There's a couple lightweight ones. Argali makes an awesome, really lightweight, very sharp knife that you can resharpen. They're actually also coming out with like a belt that has a sharpener on the belt buckle or something like that. It's pretty sweet. But you're going to want some sort of fixed blade knife to be able to get in there when you're skinning the thing and separate that. And then same thing when you're taking the skull out of the skin. If you're with a guy, they're probably going to do that for you. But if you want to do that, it's nice to have just a variety of knives and a small knife that's really sharp, that's fixed blade to kind of get in there to do that, so you're not breaking blades. So those would be kind of the knife choices there. Game bags, some reusable game bags are great. I have a couple, 5 or 6 Argali game bags. Again, they're great. They have reflective lettering on them. And so if you do have to end up hanging the meat and coming back to it, you kind of see where it is. And they're sturdy, they work, and then you can wash them, you can reuse them. So those are great. It's always nice to have some rope. If you do have to pull the thing out of a hole or something like that, if it went and died in one of those spots, if you have some rope and you can tie it out or tie it to one of the legs and pull it out, that'd be good. Or if you are hunting solo and it's just too big, you can tie one of the legs off and you can keep it up while you work on it. So those are some of the things that are probably good for that sort of process.
Nice. And then what happens? You've got meat, you've got fat. Some people wouldn't dare eat bear meat. Some people look at it as a delicacy. You know, where do you go from there? What's your take?
It's crazy just how different the bears can taste and smell. And you'll know right off, like if you're taking the hide off and you just kind of smells a little bit different, you're going to know that if you have a good bear or a bear that might need a little bit more work. I really, really like a bear sausage. You've heard of chorizo, like you can make it into bear riso. If you don't like the taste of game meat, you bury it, right? So if you're burying the meat anyway, then, you might as well just put it in a form that's going to be not distracting. So you can buy Lamb, Cabela's, and all those brands have summer sausage recipes. They have or a mix. You just add some pork fat and you grind the bear meat in with the pork fat with the seasoning. And oh my gosh, it's so good. My buddy Ryan is so good at making this bear summer sausage. And it's not like good for bear sausage. It's like good for sausage. Like I would just love this if it was at the malls with, we don't have a mall here, but I'm just thinking back to my down south days when you'd go to the mall and you'd have those Hickory Farms things where they had the summer sausage and the cheese and the cracker plates and whatnot. You could have those samples, man. His bear summer sausage is as good as any summer sausage I've ever had. And you couldn't even tell it's bear, so you don't have to make any sort of sessions, compromises for that. So, if you're not a fan of bear, then I would maybe not go like a bear steak or like a bear burger. But there's a lot of different things out there that you can add these mixes to it. And you can add some pork fat. And you can have a whole bunch of really good meat for brats, for chorizo, for summer sausage, things like that. So I would really, really encourage keeping the meat. And if it's at a time of the year where you're not required to take the meat, at least take a good amount of the meat and take it back with you along with the hide, so you can enjoy that and you can make some of that stuff work rather than try to put it on Facebook or something like that and, hey, we got some free meat, or trying to donate it. Like, spend a lot of money coming up here, might as well get some meals out of it too.
Yeah, absolutely. And, my whole philosophy is, there's no reason not to take the meat, not to eat the meat. Not to, for me, part of the adventure and anytime I go hunting something new is, okay, what's the best way to eat this? What's the best way to cook this? What can you do to make this the most palatable, to go from palatable to good to excellent? Of course, every now and then you get an animal and that particular animal is not a great one flavor wise. And you gotta, whatever you can do to replace that flavor with something else. But by and large, I think it's just one of the most enjoyable parts of the hunt that helps the hunt go year round is, what can you do with this resource now that you've got in your freezer in order to make it the best it can be and get to the point where it's not just tolerable, not just enjoyable, but, something that you look forward to serving to people who've never had it before or only had it bad. And then you give them this and their eyes light up and go, oh, wow, that is good. I that's one of my favorite parts.
Yeah, for sure. And that even comes down to salmon. Like I've had some buddies that come up to Alaska and we catch some salmon and they go home and they give most of it away because they don't like the taste of salmon. Well, you don't have to just like put a little dash of lemon pepper on it and then cook it. Like there's so many ways. Salmon is so versatile. You don't have to just cedar plank it. If you don't like the taste of salmon, that's fine. Like, find other ways to cook it in a way and flavor it in a way that's going to be good. And I think the same thing can be said for any game species. Bears is probably the one that's the, you know, biggest stretch, I guess. You know, elk is so clearly good, and caribou is so clearly good. Same thing with moose and Sitka blacktail. You know, not a lot of people are really excited about black bear, but they'll tolerate it. And there's, you know, if no other thing, it's better that you use black bear for your summer sausage than a really good tasting deer. So finding ways to make it work is pretty good.
Yeah, absolutely. So before we wrap up here, anything else you've got top of mind that you want to share or seems pertinent for the conversation and new hunters and people thinking about going after bears?
I would say that if you're looking at a hunt in Southeast Alaska, there are a couple of things to consider. First of all, you're going to fly into probably Ketchikan, and some other, you know, expenditures that, you know, people might not be thinking about is you get Alaska Airlines to Ketchikan, and then there's no large flight that goes over to Prince of Wales, which is Unit 2. Prince of Wales is the third largest island in the United States of America. Yet it only has maybe about 5,000 people. So there's an extensive road system, and you can do it DIY. But you're going to have to, there's only one, maybe two rental companies that rent vehicles. So you get on the road system, you're driving around, you know, what's your camp going to be? Do you have good camping opportunities, materials, things like that? So, you know, just be aware of that. There's some areas that rent skiffs, so you can get out to some of these other areas, because not all these areas are accessible by road, where you can get to a lot of these inlets and rivers and creeks and things like that. So if you are DIY, then you're looking at how you're going to get around the road system, how you're going to camp, and then how you're going to ship stuff back. So those are some other considerations that you look at there. And there's a lot of information that's available online. But there's some other logistical concerns when you're coming up to Southeast Alaska that have to do with the fact that you're probably going to be flying away from a community that has Alaska Airlines, and you're going to have to go, you know, either with Island Air or some of the smaller, either charter or smaller float plane areas to get flown out to some areas. You can also get flown out to an area, get dropped off, and kind of make your own bear camp and then get picked up. So it's really a buffet of options, but it's much, much different than just kind of loading up the truck, driving out somewhere and do one of those things. So take a look at a map and just kind of look around at the Ketchikan area and just look at all the islands and, you know, do your e-scouting and think about how can I get there. You know, do I need a vehicle? Am I going to need a raft? Am I going to need a skiff? Like, what are all these things? Because the last thing you want to do is come up here and be like, all right, well, now what? Or, you know, I thought I was going to take the boat from Ketchikan over to Hollis. Now I'm in Hollis and there's no hotel here. There's no restaurant here. There's nothing here, you know? So just do some research and you can go to themediocrealaskan.com. You can shoot me an email or send me a message on Instagram, something like that. If anybody, I like to, you know, help people make these sort of things a reality. But, you know, there's way more people who are experts. So if you want to, you know, talk to some guys or follow some people, that's probably a good idea too.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I really appreciate you coming on the show today, Jeff. You know, the insight is extremely valuable and really appreciate everything that you're doing.
Thanks, man. I really appreciate you having me on. It's been fun.
Yeah, absolutely. Guys, make sure you check out The Mediocre Alaskan, the podcast, check out the website, find out more about Jeff's book, and just some of the truth and the full picture of what's coming out of Alaska. Some amazing stuff there. And, you know, I think there's a lot of takeaways no matter where you're hunting, but also there's just this, you know, this intrigue that he delves into. You're just not going to find too many other places. So make sure also head to the website, newhuntersguide.com. I'll put some links in the show notes to Jeff's stuff and other things that he's mentioned on the episode. Make sure you hit subscribe, head to iTunes, leave a review with comment. Number one way to help us get shows like this out to more people. So till next time, God bless you guys and go get them in the woods.
Hey everyone, Will Cooper here, host of Hunt Stand's Make Your Mark podcast. Join us as we dive deep into the world of hunting and outdoor pursuits. We've brought together some of the most accomplished individuals in the industry to share their invaluable insights and experiences with you. But here's the kicker. It's not just about hunting tips and tactics. We're exploring how you can carve your own path, elevate your skills, and gain some wisdom from the best in the field. So whether you're a seasoned hunter looking to fine-tune your skills or a newbie eager to learn, our podcast has something for everyone. Stay tuned for more exciting guests and hotter topics. Don't miss out and subscribe to Hunt Stand's Make Your Mark podcast today and start making your mark in the great outdoors. I'm Will Cooper, and you're listening to Hunt Stand's Make Your Mark podcast on the Waypoint Podcast Network. Stick around as I bring you more stories and interviews from veteran hunters and industry professionals who inspire us all to be better equipped in the woods and in life.